This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 9th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. Now, she's a former journalist, an award-winning author, a short story writer, and the lyricist of a number of hit songs. We'll find out all about the talented Polly Sampson today on Meet the Writers on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Polly Sampson is the author of two highly acclaimed story collections. Her novel, Out of the Picture, was shortlisted for the Authors Club First Novel Award. She's won or been shortlisted for a number of other important awards, and she's written lyrics for four best-selling albums. The Kindness is her latest novel. Polly, thanks so much for coming in to chat to me. I'd like to start by talking about your life, because you had an extraordinary upbringing.
It didn't feel extraordinary to me. You know, one's upbringing just feels pretty ordinary. And in fact, it was my parents who had extraordinary upbringings, I think, more than me. My parents were both refugees in 1938, separately, child refugees. My father came on the Kinder transport from Germany, escaping Hitler. And my mother, in the same year, as a six-year-old, arrived on a slow boat from China, fleeing the Japanese. So they both had quite eventful lives. I mean, my father's life was more what you would expect. He fell into the arms of, the well-tended branches of a big family tree, and he had a good education, and he went to LSE, and rather unsurprisingly became a communist journalist and ended up as the diplomatic correspondent for the Morning Star. Whereas my mother, she was half English, half Chinese, and had been born in Shanghai, which was the home of her Chinese father. And when she came to England, her mother, who was still very young and had these three half-Chinese children, returned to her rather racist family who didn't want anything to do with... They were called the Chinky Brats. Her mother had no option than to put them in a Dr. Bernardo's home. And so my mother's early life was dreadful, and she was fostered to various quite cruel foster parents and separated from her younger siblings. And when she was 16, all she could think about was getting back to China. So she married an American Chinese war hero and with him went to Hong Kong and very, very quickly smuggled herself onto a boat and arrived in Red China, stepped off the boat, I think with thoughts of finding her father. But by this point, he'd been arrested anyway and sent off to hard labour. And she just announced, "I'm here to join your revolution." And she did. She stayed for 10 years. She rose to the rank of major. And, eventually had to get out because she and her then husband had fallen foul of Mao. And he was British, actually. And they had two small children who were coming home from nursery school and calling their parents imperialist pigs. And, they'd already sort of decided that this was not something they wanted to be part of. You know, a lot of Mao's decisions they disagreed with. And so they tried to get back to England, but they'd been reporting on the Korean War from the Chinese side, and this was now 1960, and Alan's passport, her then husband's passport, had needed renewing, and the British refused to renew it because of what they called his anti-American propaganda. And, I mean, terrible accusations were sort of flying around that he tortured prisoners of war, and it took a long time to clear his name. And my father, meanwhile, was working on the same newspaper, but in London, and he was asked to run the campaign to clear Alan's name, which he eventually did. But in the process of this, he brought my mother to England to plead at the Foreign Office, and they fell in love. And I was conceived as a result of their falling in love. So it's a complicated story for them. But my upbringing felt quite normal, because by this point in 1970, they gave up communism, they left London. My mother became a village school headmistress, and my father was the editor of the local newspaper in Cornwall. So it didn't feel that odd to me. I mean, home life wasn't quite like everyone else's. We ate Chinese food, for example, and, my parents, they were staggeringly non-materialist. But apart from that, it felt more or less not that strange.
Although in common with a lot of families who've been caught up in the Holocaust, as the other side of your family was, a lot of secrets.
A lot of secrets. I think, like many people who've survived the Holocaust, and not all of my father's family did, there's a lot of guilt. and a lot of not wanting to look back. So, for example, my father wouldn't go to Germany, you know, even until the day he died, he was very reluctant to go to Germany. Yes, there were a lot of secrets. I didn't know about my mother's life until I was 18. I knew that it had been traumatic and I knew that she'd been in China, but I knew very little about it. And what happened was she was a very good Chinese cook. And I think she was asked by the local WI, by this point we were living in Devon, to come and teach them Chinese cooking. And while she was teaching Chinese cooking, they asked her questions and she started to talk. And that then became a few talks about her life in China. And one day she just sat down and very fast wrote the book, which became Black Country to Red China. And I think I learnt about her life at the same time as everyone else.
When did you know that you could write?
I think that it's not something you know, it's something you assume that everyone... It's again, you know, I always wrote. As soon as I could pick up a pencil, I was writing and I never stopped writing. It never felt like something I started. I think that there just came a moment when I realised that not everyone did this. Actually, really, when I had my own children, I realised that they didn't sort of sit and write poetry all day in the way that I had as a child. So I suppose I sort of retrospectively realised it, but my sort of life was a progression of writing. I've worked in publishing, often with writing jobs, writing blurbs, you know, writing press releases. And then I became a journalist, so that was writing. But all the time I was sort of writing what I thought was my own private stuff that no one would ever see. Mm. So I don't feel like I ever started. I just feel like I always did.
And you've got this wonderful ability to flip between forms, as you were saying, from sort of press releases to short stories, journalism, lyrics, novels. Is it the same skill set, do you think?
Yes, I think not journalism, because, you know, you're relying so much on fact and not your imagination, but certainly all forms of fiction, poetry and lyrics, you know, it is accessing something that's maybe from your subconscious and being able to bring it out onto the page. And somehow both of those things, sometimes I think the best bits of writing for both of those forms sort of bypass the conscious. So there's something about being able to get a focus that is not at all self-conscious, I think.
We talked about writing lyrics, and I want to go into that in more detail in a moment, but I thought perhaps first we could listen to a song that you've written. And I think the one we decided that you were going to, that we were going to play first would be High Hopes, which of course, well, tell me about the song.
Okay, so I had, I was working as a journalist and my boyfriend was David Gilmour, who is now my husband. And he was working in the studio with the other members of the band. And it was the first time they'd done any sort of jamming together for, I don't know, 20 years or something. And I actually at the time had glandular fever. And I think if I hadn't had glandular fever, none of this would have happened. So I was in a very odd state. I mean, I had really high fever and was sort of practically hallucinating. And he'd come home with these pieces of music and say, I really need a lyric. How am I going to, you know, what am I going to write for this one? And I'd be lying there with my fever sort of suggesting things that might be good. And then sort of noticed after a couple of days that he was writing them all down. And then he'd sort of say, yeah, that's really great. That's great. And I think, well, it really isn't. Let me just fiddle with that. And so it happened quite organically. And I think if he'd come to me and said, I'd like you to write the lyrics for the next Pink Floyd album, I mean, I'd have run a mile. But because it just sort of happened, and I didn't imagine that my name would ever be anywhere near it, I thought, well, this is great, because, you know, by all means, pay me, but don't put my name on it. Because I had, it was a different time then. This was the, you know, early 90s. It was a much more misogynist culture, and particularly around rock and roll, and I think almost more so around Pink Floyd, who'd had no female contributors ever. And I became sort of terribly sort of scared of this idea of the Yoko Ono label, which I think about now and I think, well, what would be wrong with that? I mean, she's a very good artist. You know, why would I even worry about that? I mean, I could aspire to being Yoko Ono and having lots of good ideas and no inhibitions. But at the time I thought, no, you know, this is fine, but do not put my name on it. And David rather sensibly said, you know, there will come a time where you won't like that, because it isn't good, you will hate it. And actually, he's right. I'm now really proud of the work I did on that album, even though it was slightly unwitting. And I would hate my name not to be on it.
Here it is, High Hopes.
Beyond the horizon of the place we lived when we were young, in a world of magnets and miracles, straight constantly and without boundary,
The ringing of the division bell had begun.
Pink Floyd, High Hopes. We're speaking to the lyricist of that particular song, Polly Sampson. And not only does she write lyrics, she writes short stories, she's a journalist, she's been a journalist, she writes novels and poetry too. I wanted to talk about that side of your life, the lyric writing side of your life a little bit more, and wondered about the collaborative process and how easy it is to work alongside your husband.
Well, in those, so High Hopes is, I mean, I can't claim 100% of the lyrics. I think when we'd finished, I did this ridiculously childish thing where I got a sort of highlighter and I highlighted all my bits in pink and all David's bits in green. And so I think I know that it was a sort of 90-10 split on High Hopes. But these days I don't write lyrics with him. He writes the music and I write the lyrics. Although if he wants to write a lyric, I'm still very much sort of there as prompter and editor, and I get very involved with his lyric writing because he finds it so difficult. I find it much easier to write lyrics on my own, I suppose because of that thing of needing to be in the sort of state where I'm not actually feeling self-conscious, which I think someone else in the room does bring that on a bit.
Is it just sort of extended poetry?
No, because it's very much prompted by something that exists, which is the music. I think of it as quite interpretive and quite empathetic because, you know, David will often not know what a piece of music should be about. So, you know, sometimes I think if only he'd say, I would like this to be about the futility of war, or I would like this to be about, you know, the love that one has for one's child, or, you know, if he gave me a subject, it would possibly be easier. But actually, he expresses himself musically and he has a huge capacity for expressing himself musically, but it doesn't necessarily become something that he can express in words. So on the whole, apart from with one song which I wrote for the last Pink Floyd album, The Endless River, I think every lyric I've written has been to a piece of music. And it's the thing of just putting it in the headphones and walking and doing a thing that I know lots of people do, which is I start by writing absolute nonsense, you know, just to get the beats and the fools of the words. And then while I'm doing that, often a sort of meaning will just come kind of magically, just arrives, and then I realise what the song might be about. And at that point, I might say to David, I'm thinking that this is what the song's about. And he says, God, you're right. That is what it's about. And that's a sort of nice moment, because then I then feel free to write it. And there's something about us both being around. So although we're working separately, you know, when I finished the first draft of a lyric, I'm in that really lucky position of being able to run straight into the studio and saying, will you try and sing this? And that's often the most exciting moment. And then, you know, he will sing it and I will see where I need to change a line or just...
Do you write it with his voice in mind?
Yes, very much. It's often quite, apart from when I'm writing a story song, but even then I'm trying to write it as though looking at something through his eyes, not my own. It is an empathetic act. It has many things in common with writing dialogue for a character. Mm-hmm. I'm very conscious that this is something he's going to sing. So it wouldn't necessarily be, you know, if I were writing for a woman of my age and someone who lived a life, you know, not unlike my own, I would probably write a very different sort of lyric. So I am very conscious of him as the character who will be voicing these things.
Can you listen to other people's music while you're writing or while you're in that kind of space?
No. I mean, when I'm writing fiction, I can't listen to anything at all. I have to have total silence. I have to have the curtains drawn and I have to be in, you know, a room that is only illuminated by the keyboard. But no, I don't. In the run-up to writing some lyrics, I might listen to a lot of music just to get myself into the frame of mind and to remind myself what good lyrics are. So I'll listen to a lot of Leonard Cohen. You know, in the same way that you read, I mean, when I'm writing fiction, I read a lot of Yeats or Milton, or, you know, I will elect a poet and start the writing day by reading something really good, which actually can't be fiction because there's that danger of, you know, unwittingly plagiarising. And it's the same with lyrics. I try to listen to really great lyrics when I'm about to start writing some. But while I'm doing it, I fairly compulsively just listen to the piece of music that I'm going to be writing the lyric for.
You mentioned Milton, and your latest book, The Kindness, references Milton quite deliberately. I mean, yes. Paradise Lost is a big part of the book.
That came about, I mean, partly as a way to delay the evil day of writing, which I managed to do for a year, because I knew that I wanted my central character, Julian, to be a Milton scholar. But you can't really get under someone's skin who's a Milton scholar unless you kind of do a bit of that work yourself. So I took a year, which was quite indulgent, but I'm glad I did, to read and study Paradise Lost. And I found someone who'd very recently done it at Cambridge University. So I got him to sort of start posing the sort of questions that might be posed in an essay or a dissertation, or what, you know, something that might become a dissertation. And so I really went into it in some depth, which was incredibly rewarding. And I wouldn't have done just out of choice, although I think now I'll probably read it for the rest of my life. It never gets tired. It's always relevant to things you're thinking about or to political situations in the world. It is a fantastic reference point for all sorts of things.
And it not only appears in your new book, but also in your brand new single.
Yes, it's that was great, because I very recently finished the book, and which has this whole layer at the sort of Paradise Lost, that actually no one needs to read Paradise Lost to understand the book, but those who have would get this extra sort of thrill, I think, from the references. But there was a wonderful piece of music, very sort of upbeat, but which really spoke to me of the need to challenge authority. It had something about it, about sort of going out and not being apathetic and sort of just challenging authority. And I kept thinking of Rattle That Lock as a sort of symbol of that. And I was walking with this piece of music and, as usual, thinking, this piece of music is so great, which is a good thing and a quite inhibiting thing, because, you know, how can you improve it with words? And I started thinking about how could, you know, what would the structure of this song be? And then I remembered book two of Paradise Lost, which is Satan's incredibly heroic journey to go and challenge God and his discovery of Eden on the way. And I suddenly thought, well, that kind of has it all there. So I went back and reread book two and have had great fun with it in the lyrics of the new single.
Let's hear it. Rattle That Lock. Rattle That Lock, and the lyrics of that by Polly Sampson, who's here in the studio with me. She's a writer, not only of lyrics, of short stories, and of novels, and her latest novel is called The Kindness. It's an absolutely beautiful book, secrets revealed to us very slowly, in a very complex plot. And I'm wondering how your process works for that, if you have to sort of map it out all on a wall, perhaps you use a bit of software like Scrivener or something. How do you put it all together when there's so much to keep track of?
Oh, I wish I mapped it out. I'm always quite envious of people who can map out a novel. And I have a friend who, and I go and visit her writing room, and there's this enormous wall covered in arrows and progressions and chapter headings, and she knows exactly what she's doing. And I think, God, it's like scaffolding, and she just has to sort of hang the things off it, and what a joy. But I can't write like that. I have to not know really what's going to happen. I know who the characters are, and I know what their moral problems are, but I don't know how they're going to solve them. And I think if I did, I would lose heart. If I knew too much, in a way, for me, the joy would go out of the writing. So I don't plan anything, and in fact, I'm often quite surprised by how things work out, and everything changes all the time. I mean, I sort of go back and start at the beginning incessantly and sort of move things about and change things and change my mind. And I often do this thing which I thought was quite general, but it turns out that it isn't that general, and it's possibly akin to madness, which is something that I call method writing, where I will not sit and stare at the blank screen. I can't bear it. It's too agitating. So I go for a walk as the character. And it's sort of miraculous, because you can get yourself into that sort of deep state of thinking that you are that character and you see the world through their eyes. And suddenly you go back and you can't wait to continue with the story that is sort of centred around their decisions and their feelings, because you understand them so well by that point.
Polly, without spoiling the plot of the book, perhaps you could tell us a bit about it.
Oh, right. So it's about a man called Julian who falls madly in love with an older woman who he sees one day when he has a terrible hangover flying a hawk. It turns out not to be her hawk, but her husband's hawk. And she's been in this brutalised marriage since she was very young. And they decide to be together, and he chucks in his wonderful academic life, and they go together to London. And the problem with this is that the very start of their relationship, there has been a lie. And it might be a lie of kindness or it might be a lie of self-interest. And this all sort of unravels as they live their lives in a sort of rather idyllic setting, because Julian manages to buy back his childhood home, which is called Ferdows, which, you know, as my own private joke, is the highest point of paradise in the Quran. So you can see I was constantly bringing it back to ideas of paradise. And everything unravels. The child becomes ill. And when the child becomes ill and is being treated in Great Ormond Street, the original lie comes back and slaps him in the face. And the second half of the book is told from Julia's point of view. And there are a lot of twists and turns because of people's motivations are not exactly what they seem in the first half.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book.
Thank you.
It's called The Kindness. It's by Polly Sampson. It's been out in the UK for a while now, but just being published now in America. Some absolutely stunning reviews. And I recommend you read it.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Very many thanks to my guest, Polly Sampson. The Kindness is published by Bloomsbury. Do tune in next week when my guest will be the Turkish journalist and writer, Ahmet Altan. But for now, from me, Georgina Godwin, thank you for listening.